Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering canoes, kayaks, and advice for anyone wanting to experience solitude on Wisconsin waterways. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or RutabagaShop.com.
So, Ginger, how did you become interested in exploring the connection between the development of the American interstate system and the rise of highway killers?
Well, I started out writing about the interstate highway generally. I was interested in what it had done to the nation and kind of the psychological effect that it had on us. And then that kind of just naturally led me to the question of the freeway killer, which I was originally thinking of as, you know, a real thing, but also a kind of metaphor for what the highways did, what they did to communities, what they did to our landscapes. And, you know, once you open up the door and let the serial killers in the book, they take over.
They have a way of doing that.
They really do.
So would you go so far as to say that there was a direct, that there's a direct correlation, that the construction of the interstate system, the highways, led to highway violence?
Well, that's, you know, that's kind of the interesting question of the book. And at first it looked as if that was true, because violence shot up in America at the same time that we built the highway system. And there was a lot of hand-wringing about that and people talking about the, you know, rootlessness and this new mobility and the fact that people weren't tied to their communities and their families anymore and that that was leading to violence. And then, of course, the violence levels in the nation dropped again in the 1980s, and there are a number of reasons for that. So I don't think the correlation is as one-to-one as you might expect, but I do think that it quickly became the way we see our highways and the way we think about them. We think about them as violent places and scary places, and, you know, if your car breaks down, don't get out of the car.
Mm. Well, you write about a moment when the nation as a whole began to associate the highway system with murder. You write about the arrest of Charles Starkweather and his girlfriend, who, I guess it sounds like they were America's first highway killers.
Certainly they were the first ones to be seen that way. I mean, historically, roads have always carried violence. It happens, you know, in ancient times. It's where we get the term highwayman.
Hmm.
But
or I think
you
about,
know,
you know, all the myths of the crossroads. You know, long before
exactly.
There were highways, crossroads were dangerous places.
That's right. You know, a road is a dangerous thing because anyone can come down it. But Charles Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugate were the first people, you know, to go on the lam and be kind of depicted as highway killers, even though most of the killing that they did actually happened in their hometown. They started with Carol Ann's family and moved on to locals before they went on the lam and killed a couple people along the way.
How did their arrest play out in, I don't know, public consciousness?
Oh, it was huge. It was national headlines across the whole nation. The Nebraska governor called out the National Guard. Kids walked down the streets in Lincoln, Nebraska, yelling, "Come out, Charlie, come out." You know, they were definitely mediagenic. You know, they were these cute kids from the heartland, and they just went wrong.
What happened? I mean, did they just set out to go kill a lot of people?
You know, they started out by killing Carol Ann's family. And it was, you know, Carol Ann was later pardoned, so it's unclear how much she was involved. But the way Charles summed it up was people were getting in our way. They wanted to get out of town. They wanted to get somewhere. And they were frustrated. They were both frustrated kids, and they just lashed out.
Hmm. At one point in your book, you write that behind the wheel, we're all psychopaths. Can you explain what you mean? That's such a chilling comment.
But it's true, isn't it? I mean, if you're honest with yourself, you know, when you find yourself in the car, I don't think I'm alone in this, yelling things that you would never say to a perfect stranger or another human being. But when you're in your car, you begin to see other people as machines, because you're looking at the machine that they're inside, and you're thinking about it, and you get paranoid. And people have, you know, actually done the neurological research and the psychological research that shows that we do, you know, we get kind of paranoid when we are denied the human contact that we crave as human animals. Hmm. And that really does make us, on some level, psychopathic.
So it sounds like you think the car is somewhat dehumanizing. Is the highway system even more so?
I think so, yeah. I think that's a really good way of putting it. The car dehumanizes us, and the highway, I came to think of while I was working on this book, I came to think of the interstate highway system as a machine. It's a vast machine, and it, you know, cars travel along it the way information travels through a computer. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting that we use the same metaphors to talk about them.
That's interesting, thinking of it metaphorically. I was thinking more physically and concretely. You know, if you ever spent much time driving on an interstate highway, there is a godforsaken feeling to it all.
Oh, there really is. I have a friend who calls it interstatia. It's the 51st state. And it has its particular rules, and time passes in a certain way on the interstate. If you've ever read John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie, he makes this really interesting comment that he had to get off the interstate because he couldn't stand being so in his own head. Hmm. He was trapped in his own head as he was moving through this bland, dull landscape.
Is there any evidence that people who spend a lot of time on the interstates, you know, like long-distance truckers, long-haul truckers, are actually more violent?
Well, I do talk about this in the book, and that's a question that no one really wants to ask. There is an epidemic of murder going on in the long-haul trucking industry. The FBI has created a special division, the Highway Serial Killers Initiative, to deal with it. And, you know, they will only talk about it in the broadest terms and talk about the fact that there are so many trucks on the road that it's just inevitable that some of them are going to turn out to be criminals.
I don't know. There are a lot of airplanes in the sky, and I'm not sure that we're terribly worried about an epidemic of serial killers amongst pilots.
Yeah. I think there are even more truckers than there are pilots. And I think that, you know, the highway system generates the kind of convergences, that's the criminological way of saying it, that create crime. In other words, it puts people with the opportunity to do a crime together with easy victims, and those are truck stop prostitutes.
Hmm. You know, it wasn't always like this, was it? I mean, back in the 40s and 50s, you write about a time when everybody hitchhiked. It was ordinary to hitchhike, to just take
to
the roads.
Yeah. It was entirely normal. Even Emily Post thought that if you were going to your job, particularly during the war, if you were going to your job at a defense plant, it made sense to hitchhike. People picked up soldiers because soldiers used hitchhiking as a way of getting around the country, and it was your patriotic duty, in fact.
You remember that old film, the one with Claudette Colbert and,
mm-hmm.
oh, who's
it happened
the leading
one night?
Yes.
Clark Gable.
Yes, and aren't they out on the highway and they're trying to, yeah, they're hitchhiking and she flashes a leg and it's all, you know, just in good
yes.
fun.
Yes. It was frequently used as a, you know, what Hollywood calls a meet cute. Hmm. Somebody hitchhikes and meets somebody that way. It wasn't seen as dangerous. It had to be specifically redefined as dangerous, and that happened kind of beginning in the 1950s with the FBI campaign that really picked up in the 1960s, and then it gained speed in the 70s simply because there were so many hitchhikers then.
What was the FBI's anti-hitchhiking campaign, and why were they against hitchhiking?
Well, one theory is that J. Edgar Hoover was really against the fact that students were hitchhiking to the South to register voters and to hitchhiking from college to college to take part in demonstrations and protests and civil rights marches and things like that. Hoover was particularly, he particularly hated hitchhiking and saw it as a personal mission to get rid of it. And, you know, we don't really have the statistics or the evidence to know if it was in fact dangerous.
So are you saying that by the 60s, hitchhiking had taken on certain countercultural associations? It became associated with hippies and flower children?
Absolutely. And the hippies and flower children embraced hitchhiking as a way of, you know, it was part of their lifestyle. It was a way of being less materialist because you didn't have to own a car. It was a way of being more connected because you moved from place to place and met strangers and shared things with them, shared a ride, shared conversations. It was part of their entire lifestyle. And so when cities and towns and even some states began passing anti-hitchhiking ordinances, the hippies saw that as, you know, a form of harassment and a way of lashing out at the counterculture.
The man trying to shut them down. So the highway
to shut them down.
The highway was the landscape of freedom.
Exactly. And, you know, the man wanted them to buy their own car. And the hippies, you know, they felt that that shouldn't have to be the case.
So how did the FBI actually go about discouraging hitchhiking?
They actually made propaganda posters and placed articles in popular magazines and newspapers. So you see, if you look at the popular media, you see this vast shift from the 1940s and 50s and even the 60s, where hitchhiking is often written up as a reasonable, fun way to get around and, you know, an adventure that you can take. And, you know, by the late 70s, the only kind of article you read is, you know, hitchhiking. It's like playing Russian roulette.
What did those posters look like?
There was a famous one that had a picture of a man in a suit, and he's got his back to the viewer, and there's a car with a family in it, and this man in the suit is hitchhiking, and the poster's titled "Death in Disguise." And there's kind of a skull, you know, superimposed on the whole thing.
Wait. So the hitchhiker was the one who was dangerous.
Yes.
Because
originally
that's
the
shifted.
Hitchhiker. Yes, it did. It shifted in the 1970s with the countercultural embrace of hitchhiking.
So how did it switch from the hitchhiker was the dangerous predator to the people in the car picking up the hitchhiker were potentially predators?
Yeah, I think that what happened is there were a few very high-profile cases of people who used hitchhiking as a means of serial killing. In my book, I write about Ed Kemper, who was person who lived in Santa Cruz and cruised the highways endlessly picking up hitchhikers and sometimes killing them. So, you know, for every one of those cases, the media just produced a lot of anxiety and fear about hitchhiking.
How many hitchhikers did he kill?
Ed Kemper, I actually don't know the answer to that question. Okay. Offhand, I'd have to look at my book. If you want
no, that's okay.
to ask me the question, I can look it up. But you
no,
know.
Just tell me something. Who was this guy, Ed Kemper?
Ed Kemper was a very mentally disturbed man. He was even disturbed as a young boy. At the age of 16, he killed his grandparents. When the police came to arrest him, they asked him for an explanation, and he said, "I just wanted to see what it would feel like to kill grandma." He was subsequently incarcerated for the rest of his teen years in Atascadero, the state hospital for the criminally insane in California, and that did not do him any good mentally. So when he came back out, he became a career serial killer. He got himself a police-like car and cruised the highways endlessly looking for a particular kind of hitchhiking woman. He liked them to be well-dressed and neat, and, you know, he didn't really go for the hippie types.
Wow. You can see that that must have just gone straight into the collective unconscious, because that's exactly what I grew up being afraid of. I can practically hear my mother saying, you know, that's what happens to girls who hitchhike.
Yep, me too. It was always, you know, by the time I was raised, it was just something that you never, ever, ever did.
And there were, you mentioned there were cities and towns who actually then made it illegal to hitchhike, right?
Yes. There was an interesting book written in the 1970s, the Hitchhiker's Field Guide, I think it was called, where, you know, proponents of hitchhiking kind of gave their advice and information about which states were more friendly, which states were unfriendly. California was especially friendly to hitchhiking. Colorado was known to be unfriendly to it.
So aside from the public hysteria, was or is hitchhiking that dangerous?
Well, again, it's an interesting question because no one's ever actually studied it. There was one report written in the late 70s by the California Highway Patrol, and they looked at all the crimes that were reported over a number of years and how many of them were associated with hitchhiking, and it was significantly less than 1%. So it was not, if you're looking at reported crimes, it did not increase your chance of becoming a victim.
Wow. Doesn't that strike you as odd that it hasn't actually been that studied?
Yeah, yeah. It strikes me as very odd.
I mean, why do you think that is?
Part of me thinks maybe the hippies were right, you know? It could, in fact, be that we're just, as a society, we're more comfortable with people being in their own space. It's why we love our cars. It's very anti the car culture to hitchhike. You know, we think of our cars as private space. It's like inviting a stranger into your home for dinner.
Yeah, well, maybe the powers that be don't especially want strangers meeting up and discovering that they have common interests and like each other.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though. There's been a bit of a resurgence. I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times pointing out that hitchhiking was not necessarily as dangerous as we've all been led to believe.
Oh, that your op-ed basically called for people to start hitchhiking again.
Yes, it did. And I got lots of email from people all over the country pointing out that they were part of various kinds of projects. You know, in today's world where we're also wired, hitchhiking is actually can be much safer than it ever could. You can take a photo of the car before you step in it, including the license plate, and immediately text that to your mother or someone else if you don't want to tell your mother that you're hitchhiking. But, you know, people are much more able to protect themselves than they were in the 1970s. And there's quite an active hitchhiking culture, although they don't call it hitchhiking, in many cities. Washington, D.C., surprisingly, is one of them. It's known there as slugging. Yeah, the slugs line up at designated places, and people who want to drive in the HOV lanes pick them up.
I don't know. You said it's safer now with cell phones and you can snap pictures. There's a part of me that thinks, yeah, that just means that maybe they'll catch your killer after you've been left dismembered by the side of the road.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's a question of whether we want to invest in trusting people, whether we want to be the kind of culture that trusts people, or whether we're really committed to our distrust of anyone we don't know.
So I'm curious, do you ever hitchhike or pick up hitchhikers yourself?
I do, yeah. I was recently in Oregon, and picked up some snowboarders who were hitchhiking up to Mount Hood for obvious reasons. They had their snowboards in their hands. You know, there are many situations like that where it seems pretty clear what's going on. And I have hitchhiked, but I very rarely get picked up. People don't tend to pick up hitchhikers. The last time I did it was just a couple months ago. I was in San Francisco with my teenage daughter, and we got stuck due to a public transit meltdown and hitchhiked back into the city.
When somebody picked you up, well, who picked you up?
A very nice woman who lived in the neighborhood where we were and said she, you know, she picked us up because she had always had problems with the buses herself. And, you know, we had a lovely conversation and
did
went
you
across
ask,
the Bay Bridge.
Did you ask her why she picked you up?
No, she just offered that information. Mm. It was interesting. But, you know, we were two women. It wasn't, we didn't seem threatening.
Mm. Well, on the other hand, I mean, the point of your book really is that it's not so much the hitchhiker as, in some ways, the highway, the highway itself that evokes this sense of fear or unease in us. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, I think so. It's the highway itself, and it's the world that grew up around it, and the kind of world that it creates. The highway creates a very disconnected world that's not on a human scale. You know, it's on an automotive scale.
Can you say more about it? I mean, I still don't understand why. I mean, when the highways were built, there was this great sense of national pride. This was a huge public works project. And you can imagine that we might still feel proud of it, and yet there's these sinister overtones.
Yeah, it's really true. It's very much, you know, to me, it was very much about economics. When the highway system was first proposed and when the first highways were built, people loved them. They saw them as beautiful. You know, I looked through endless car ads, and car ads used to include interstate highways. There would be a picture of the interstate highway. There was one even, I can't remember which car brand it was, that encouraged people to write in and vote for their what they thought was the most beautiful interstate, the interstates. And it didn't take very long for these, you know, these dreamways, as they were called, to be recast as highways to hell. And I think that one of the reasons for that is the effect that they had on urban areas and on landscapes. You know, at one point in California, the highway engineers proposed dropping 23 nuclear bombs on the Bristol Mountains in order to carve a path for I-40.
Wow.
And that just confirmed, and luckily it didn't happen, but they were going to set up bleachers so that they could bring in dignitaries to watch. Everyone was very excited about this, and people who kind of thought skeptically about that said, you know, this is what the highway system is. It's a kind of war on nature and a war on our landscape. And the environmentalist movement began recasting the highways as killers of landscapes and stranglers of cities.
Well, you have a really interesting chapter on Atlanta, for instance, and we forget what the highway system also did, not just to the landscape, but to cities and communities.
Yeah. Over 1 million people were displaced by the highway program. Atlanta tore down one-third of their housing stock. One-third.
Wow.
They displaced one-third of their citizens in order to build freeways and the urban renewal housing projects that went with them, which, of course, became a disastrous kind of landscape to live in.
Right, and so it's not just that a third of the people were moved. It's which people and where they were moved and which
yes.
other people were separated. So there's, you know, sort of a secret, I've forgotten what's the word I'm looking for. Never mind. There was, you know, some kind of darker political intent, you could almost suggest.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it was a form of redlining in a way. The highway engineers would look at a map of tax revenues and they would draw the line through the lowest numbers. So it was always disproportionately the poorest and most disadvantaged people who were displaced by the highway system. Then the highways led to white flight and suburbanization, and the jobs fled the inner city, And so the people who were left behind in the city, you know, slid further and further into being an underclass.
So there is something murderous about the highway system.
Absolutely. The highways killed communities.
I'm curious, other countries have superhighway systems. Germany has its Autobahn. Italy has its Autostrada. Do they also have similar morbid associations with their highways?
I believe they do, yes. And certainly in Canada, the same kind of thing happens. The highways have been associated with crimes, with murder in particular, murder of truck stop prostitutes. I did a small bit of research towards the end of my book looking into, well, what happens when other countries build huge highway systems, looking at Mexico and China, and it did seem to be the case that violence follows in its wake.
So we were all the way toward thinking that there are very real political and economic reasons why America's highway system has this kind of murderous connotation. But now when you say that about other countries, it makes me think, no, there's something even deeper, almost, you know, mythological about our association of highways and death.
Yeah, I mean, again, it goes back to the ancients, and it goes forward as well. You know, the point at which a nation builds a highway system is the point at which it's committing to a particular kind of culture, a culture that is prioritizing speed and movement and mobility and restlessness. And those things have a dark side.
One reviewer speculated that your book could have the same impact on road tripping that the movie Jaws had on swimming, which was a great line.
It was a good line. It certainly wasn't my intent because, of course, to me, the real violence of the highway system is what the actual roads did to communities and to the landscape, and in particular to our built world. The highway killers are kind of they're outliers. The roads are not filled with psycho killers.
Well, it sounds like, you know, you kind of think of them as the symbols of the much larger murder that went on.
Exactly.
So I'm curious, has writing this book had any impact on you yourself, on the way you think of driving, especially driving on the interstate?
It has, yeah. I'm much more aware of what's going on at truck stops, for instance. I spent a lot of time hanging around truck stops trying to understand them and how they worked. I've always been a traveler. I travel a lot for work, and I'm an enthusiastic driver in spite of my skepticism about car culture. I have to admit that I enjoy road trips. And I did, you know, do a lot of road tripping in the cause of the book. One thing I did was trace the path that Charles Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugate took when they went on the lam.
Oh, that's a cheery road trip.
It was. I took my daughter on the serial killer road trip. We camped. It was fun.
Well, I don't know. I've had your book has had the opposite impression on me. In some ways, I wanted never to step into another truck stop again. But I'm curious, your book, the ultimate message is pretty depressing. And I know you've said it was kind of a downer to write. Has anything hopeful come out of it for you?
Well, look, I mean, you can go to a truck stop. You're very unlikely, even though this is the way the media spins it frequently. You know, American families are endangered by this epidemic of serial killing. That's not true. Go to the truck stop. Just don't turn any tricks. That's my advice to you. You know, I think that oddly enough, it became apparent to me in writing the book that the killers on the road are in fact outliers. They are the odd case, and that the vast majority of people on the road, the vast majority of truckers even, are good, solid human beings who will help each other out in an emergency. And if you look at the statistics, they bear that out. So I think that the book, for me, has the opposite effect of what you're talking about. But I can see why having to, you know, think about these gruesome murder cases makes one a little leery.
But aside from the murder cases, you know, we're left with this image of this concrete network of death spread across the country. You know, now
that's
that we've
nice. I like that.
Now that we've built the interstate system, you know, we're stuck with it kind of forever. You can't really imagine it going away.
You can't imagine it. You can't imagine it going away. But the funny thing is, it could. If you think about how we dismantled a huge and expensive system of infrastructure, being our rail and light rail infrastructure, in order to replace it with the highways, then you can get kind of optimistic, because we do tend to think about infrastructure in this funny way. We think like, oh, it's permanent. We're saddled with it forever, for all time. It's not true. We've taken our infrastructure apart in this country multiple times and replaced it with something new. And I think that, you know, if anything, I would like to remind people that there is hope, that we could, in fact, dismantle our road network and have something better someday.
And imagine how many jobs would be created dismantling the highways.
Exactly, and getting rid of all those cars.
Thanks so much for talking.
Thank you.